From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Coming up in Forum's opening hour this morning, more than 40 Sunni prisoners were killed today by pro-government Shiite militiamen at a jail northeast of Baghdad after insurgents tried to storm the jail and free them. As sectarian violence increases, Secretary of State John Kerry says the United States is weighing its options to stem the advance of the insurgents, which range from drone strikes to cooperation with Iran. What, if anything, can the United States do to prevent the disintegration of Iraq? We'll discuss the ongoing Iraq crisis next. Join us and join in after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Good morning and welcome to this morning's Forum program. ISIS, the Al-Qaeda-inspired Sunni militant group which has seized vast areas of Iraq over the past year, claimed mass executions of some 1,700 Shiite soldiers as it gained control of Tal Afar, west of Mosul, after 2 days of fierce fighting. That number of executions has been disputed, but it is clear the group wants to incite sectarian strife and establish an independent caliphate bordering on both Iraq and Syria. With close proximity of ISIS to Baghdad and a possible sectarian war looming, President Obama announced yesterday that several hundred armed troops would be deployed and special forces soldiers sent to protect U.S. personnel in the American embassy in Baghdad, while he also assured Americans that the United States would not be pulled into another war. Earlier today, 44 Sunni prisoners were killed in a government-controlled police station in Bakuba, north of Baghdad, and the bodies of four young men who had been shot were found dumped on a street in a Baghdad neighborhood controlled by Shiite militiamen. Earlier, about an hour ago, I spoke with Jia Gol, who is a BBC correspondent in Baghdad, about the ever-widening crisis, and I asked him about the recent violence in Bakuba.
Well, there is a conflicting report, as you said, but we talked to some people inside Bakuba. One of our local reporters, he said, the situation is very dire. People are frightened. They really scared because last night there was a tense fighting between security forces and ISIS fighters. Somehow the report came first last night that ISIS fighters took over the city, but today the government says they have taken over the city. But one of the story captured everyone's attention was the killing of 44 prisoners in police station. The government says it was they were killed by a grenade thrown by ISIS fighters, but ISIS says it was the government. There doesn't make sense for ISIS to kill its own prisoners because those people were arrested on terrorist charges. In fact, the police, before abandoning their station, they accused them that they killed those prisoners. So this image is coming out really inflame the situation. Many people in Baghdad, they are afraid because Bakuba is just 60 kilometers north of Baghdad. And if ISIS manage to capture the city, if they can get onto the main highway, it's less than an hour drive to Baghdad, which really many people here, the resident of Baghdad, are very concerned about the situation.
Well, how secure is Baghdad?
Well, since last week, the security has been increased tremendously. If you drive around Baghdad, almost every intersection, there is a checkpoint, and they search you, they check you. So there is a lot of police and security forces around and inside Baghdad. And yesterday I was on my way to Najaf, in the Shia city. We're driving toward Najaf. There was convoys of military vehicles. They were coming toward Baghdad. Seems the government policy and the military policy is to pull out their troops from the safer area, the Shia area, which is safer and predominantly are Shia, pull the troops and move them toward Baghdad and around Baghdad in other provinces like Bakuba, like in Salah ad-Din and Anbar. So the fight is continuing in many, many different fronts.
We're talking to Jia Gol, who is BBC correspondent in Baghdad. I wonder if you could give us a sense of what you feel or what you have been able to measure from the people themselves. Is there support for ISIS from Sunni residents, or are they fearful of ISIS particularly? And the Shia clearly are fearful of them, but to what extent are they behind the Maliki government?
Well, there is a lot of criticism toward Prime Minister Maliki, his style of his leadership style. I mean, yesterday I meet Muqtada Sadr, spokesman, one of the leader of the Shia groups in Najaf, and he quite pointedly he accused Prime Minister Maliki's style causing this chaos in the country. He said two years ago he crushed the Sunni demonstration, in fact caused these grievances. That's why many Sunnis in those areas, Tikrit, Mosul, supported ISIS. In fact, many Sunnis, they don't like ISIS, but in the same time they are not happy with the Shia government because they think he is monopolizing them and he completely ignored them. And in fact, his policy in the past few years has been very divisive, and even the Kurds has a problem with the prime minister. So that's why many people are critical of him. In the same time, many Sunni are afraid. And for those of us who covered Iraq in 2006 and 2007 during sectarian violence, it's all too familiar. I mean, today in Baghdad, four bodies were found in east of Baghdad in a Shia neighborhood, believed to be a Sunni, have been killed. So this extrajudiciary killing and the kidnapping, it might renew that sectarian violence we witnessed a few years ago. So a lot of people are very worried, not just in Sunni community, in Shia community too, because the Sunni militia might take revenge. And again, Sunni Shia militia, particularly after the fatwa was issued by Ayatollah Sistani, they call on all Iraqis to join the fight against ISIS. And many militia groups found excuse to recruit and retrain a lot of people. And many people in Baghdad, particularly the largest city in Iraq, they are worried this might fuel the tension between Sunni and Shia.
That was the BBC's Jia Gol in Baghdad. As I said, I spoke with him about an hour ago. And let me tell you who we have assembled to talk with us about the ongoing crisis in Iraq. Martha Crenshaw, senior fellow with the Center for International Security and Cooperation at the Freeman Spogli Institute for International Studies at Stanford University, and joins us from the Stanford campus this morning. Welcome, Martha Crenshaw.
Thank you.
Glad to have you. Also glad to have Aaron David Miller back with us, Vice President for New Initiatives and Distinguished Scholar with the Woodrow Wilson International Center for Scholars. He's also been an advisor to both Republican and Democratic Secretaries of State, and has a new book out, The End of Greatness, Why America Can't Have and Doesn't Want Another Great President. That'll be out in October. Look forward to reading it. Aaron, good to have you back on Forum.
Always a pleasure to be here.
Also want to welcome Jeffrey White, who is with us this morning. He's Defense Fellow with the Washington Institute for Near East Policy. He spent 34 years at the Defense Intelligence Agency, and his work there included planning for the 2003 invasion of Iraq. Welcome, Jeffrey White.
Thank you very much.
Martha Crenshaw, let me begin with you. You are sort of our resident expert on terrorism here, and let me get a sense of who and what ISIS is. And under the leadership of Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi, clear they want a caliphate. They clearly want, as I said earlier, sectarian violence. And at this point, we're in a pretty serious crisis state. I mean, they've taken Mosul. That's the second biggest city in Iraq.
Indeed, that was a significant accomplishment on their part, and I think it came as a surprise to many of us, although we had followed their rise with some attention and alarm. This is a group that is more radical even than al-Qaeda itself. It's related to the al-Qaeda in Iraq, which, as you know, was founded by one Zarqawi, who himself was sort of reluctant to even engage in an alliance with al-Qaeda, and who was criticized by the leader of al-Qaeda now for his ruthlessness and his sectarianism. So this is a group that is even more sectarian, even more violent, even more radical than the root home al-Qaeda. And it got its start in Iraq. It then was able to take advantage of the civil war in Syria, where it gained even more strength. was on the outs, really, in many ways, in Iraq before violence began in Syria, and now is able to move back toward its territory in Iraq from which, you know, a position in which it was discredited at the time of the Arab Awakening. So Syria really provided a launching board for them and enabled them to try to pursue and indeed to be successful in pursuing their aim of a caliphate that would link Syria and parts of Iraq.
Well, you mentioned that Divan al-Zawahiri finds them too excessive. What does that mean? I mean, does that translate to their wanting to slaughter members of the Shia Muslim faith? I mean, that certainly was characteristic of al-Qaeda in Iraq to a great degree, was it not?
It was. It largely is their propensity for killing fellow Muslims rather than their propensity for killing non-Muslims or the enemy. And the idea being not so much, well, in part sectarianism, Sunni versus Shia, but also the use of violence against fellow Sunnis who are regarded as less than sufficiently devout and devoted to the jihadist cause as, in effect, as traitors to the cause. So violence.
Traitors in a country
Muslims,
that was secular for many years under Saddam Hussein.
It was secular. Well, it was secular in some ways, not secular in other ways. And in many ways, al-Qaeda and its various ramifications came up against tribal norms and mores. And when it violated those norms in a variety of ways, then it led to splits between the more traditionally oriented groups, Ba'athist groups, and the more sectarian Shia groups. Now you see them banding together again, unfortunately, because of the failure of the Maliki government to bring Sunnis into the government and to be more inclusive.
And the Sunnis are certainly outraged and angry, Aaron David Miller, because they've been purged from government ranks. There's been really ethnic cleansing by the Maliki government. They've been prosecuting the most senior Sunni politicians and breaking up peaceful protests by force. And at this point, are we at a divide that really presents an almost, I hate to characterize it as such, but impossible role for the United States of any kind?
Well, not an impossible role, not even an implausible role. The question is, What is the end game? And I ask this question and pose it only because so many times we act without thinking. We treat military force as if it were the end state and not a tactic to achieve a set of clearly defined political objectives. I'm not an expert in Iraq, and I'll defer to Jeffrey on the military side. What I am an expert in is dumb ideas, because I worked for half a dozen secretaries of state over a 20-plus year period, and I know when the United States gets either too risk ready or too risk averse, but in either scenario, loses sight of its fundamental objectives. There's one primary problem. It was true in 2003, and it's true now. Iraq is handicapped by what it is, its demography, and where it is, its geography, and those are two elements that nations find it almost impossible, certainly on the geographic piece, impossible to alter. And the reality is we're watching a situation in Iraq now in which the problem is not the absence of a lack of an American military response, not the fact that the Obama administration, and perhaps they looked for the exits much too quickly, failed to negotiate a status of forces agreement or leave a considerable residual presence. We're dealing with a fundamentally broken and dysfunctional state, in which the power balance has been fundamentally altered from a minority that ruled Iraq under Saddam to a minority and a majority, the Shia community, who now are back in and under Nur al-Maliki, determined to remain exclusive and even triumphalist. So the reality is, yeah, we could blow up a lot of stuff. We could send special forces in. We may do that. We can ramp up the presence in Baghdad of our embassy, and we need to do that to protect the embassy and to facilitate an evacuation if necessary. But the question is, what is it that we're designed, that we're trying to do? And in the end, how does military force, and the question is not a rhetorical one, it's a question for Jeff, how does military force fundamentally alter the what Iraq is and the where it is problem? Because the Iranians ultimately, in my judgment, stand to be the big winners here, even though they have a stake in checking these Sunni jihadists.
They stand to be big winners unless we find a war taking place like took place in the 80s. In fact, I read your article with great interest where you said we don't need an Iraq War III, but we could certainly see a war like took place under Saddam Hussein between these two countries. And we could see World War III coming out of this. I just read, in fact, UN Commission on Syrian War Crimes saying a regional war in the Middle East draws ever closer.
Well, a regional war requires conventional military force, not asymmetrical warfare. It requires powers to literally mobilize forces against one another or the intervention of a third party in a significant way. No, I think the Iranians stand to gain in large part because the Shia may well be the beneficiary of what could be an ISIS overreach, number one. And number two, we can't lose sight of the fact that ISIS is not the only problem. You've got Sunni tribes and various other groups who are not related to ISIS, but are thriving on the exclusivity and triumphalism of Mr. Maliki. They are now associated and allied with ISIS elements, but they create and pose a huge problem to the long-term stability of this country. We're stuck, Michael. I'm sorry to say, we really are stuck. And while I think the president will act, I think we'll end up blowing up some stuff. I'm not entirely sure how effective over time it's going to be without a fundamental realignment of the political structure in this country, and I don't see that coming.
We're talking to Aaron David Miller, and just another thing on the record here from you, Aaron. You've said that we're not going to fix Iraq until we fix Syria, and we have been utterly ineffectual on that score.
It's true, and just one other point. You know, the argument is now circulating that ISIS will pose a direct threat to the continental United States. I take the point.
Look at all the money they have from Mosul. I mean,
right? I take the point. But, you know, last year, according to the State Department report on terrorism, 17,800 global fatalities to terrorism. You know how many Americans are among those 17,800? 16. So before we lose our heads and turn this current situation into another Iraq II, we have to keep in mind, yes, we are not safe. We may be safer than we were on 9/11. But we have to think very clearly about how American military action affects our end game and what unintended consequences it might have.
Well, again, let me defer here to Jeffrey White, as you said, who's defense fellow with the Washington Institute for Near East Policy and spent 34 years at the Defense Intelligence Agency, and his work included planning for the 2003 invasion of Iraq. Everybody's saying, Jeffrey White, we cannot put American boots on the ground. We can't afford to do that again. But there is a real threat here. I mean, particularly because ISIS has made it very clear that the United States is in its straight hairs, and the United States is also an enemy.
Well, I don't think we're contemplating putting any serious numbers of boots on the ground in Iraq or in Syria, for that matter. The president has decided to reinforce the embassy there. That's clearly the mission of protecting the embassy and the people that work there. And as Aaron said, to prepare for an evacuation if necessary. The much more likely thing, but not certain thing, I think, is that we will conduct some kind of airstrikes or air operations against ISIS. Probably most likely in Iraq itself, but maybe to include ISIS positions and activities in Syria.
Well, excuse me, would that include drone use?
Probably. There's a number of issues here about getting forces into the theater. Getting permission to fly drones out of neighboring countries, getting permission from countries to fly U.S. aircraft out of them against permissions against or into Iraq. So it's not so simple. But I think we're the best option here for us in a military sense is airstrikes if the president decides to go that route. There was a lot of panic last week that Baghdad was going to fall either in the next night or the next day, and that has I think significantly abated. The fighting is settling down in Iraq. We don't see the swift movements and advances by ISIS that we saw before. the Maliki government is mobilizing, you know, regular forces, militia forces, volunteers to fight back against ISIS. So what we're likely to see is the situation become, you know, more stable in a military sense, settle down into more of a slugfest or battle of attrition. And then you have to ask yourself, okay, in that context, what kind of U.S. military operations would actually help the situation? So it's not so much a matter now of any kind of knee-jerk U.S. military reaction. It's, you know, more of a deliberate planning, more of a, you know, careful decision-making process, gathering of intelligence, and then deciding what's necessary and what we're going to do.
Now, without sounding too ominous, I had mentioned all that money that came out of the Mosul banks. We're talking about hundreds of millions of dollars and also billions in gold, probably. This gives ISIS extraordinary resources to fall back on. And if we are, as some think, on the cusp of what Afghanistan was in the 90s as a safe haven from which to attack the United States, there may be, at least in terms of not necessarily the short run, but the long run, some pretty serious things at stake here.
Well, that's quite true, but we have to see what use ISIS actually makes of all this territory, material, and money it has gained. Certainly, it has an enormous war chest, and that's going to allow it to build forces, purchase weaponry, do better in terms of governance of areas that it's taken control of, plan for future operations, and so on. But ISIS also has a big issue here now of what is it going to do with all this territory it's taken under its nominal control.
Seems to be building an infrastructure.
It is, but it's doing it on a shoestring. There's probably no more than 5,000 or 6,000 ISIS combatants involved in the fighting in Iraq. That's not a lot of people for controlling large cities and huge spaces. It's going to have to work with other parties inside Iraq, Sunni tribes, former Baathists, already apparently is doing so. So it's got a governance problem in its own right of actually extending its control, you know, real control over the areas that it has taken. And it's going to have to do that against increasing pressure from Iraqi forces. I don't think the Iraqi government is going to be satisfied with letting ISIS sit on top of these places. And in its own kind of clumsy and incompetent way, it's going to, you know, mobilize to regain some of these areas.
We're coming up on a break here, a hard break, but I wanted to actually go back to Martha Crenshaw, if I can, Martha, and ask for kind of a quick thumbnail sketch from you about where the Kurds fit into this. They're holding Kirkuk, and they're certainly tough fighters. They don't necessarily want to ally themselves with Malachi, but what do you see?
Well, I certainly see this could be both a threat and an opportunity for them because they now have moved into Kirkuk. They can protect themselves, I think, quite effectively, much more effectively than Maliki could. And he's going to struggle to control Shia militias like Muqtada al-Sadr, who was his enemy at one time. So I don't think it's going to be so easy for Maliki to mobilize against ISIS. But for the Kurds, they've shown a remarkable unity, particularly in light of their past. And I think that they will probably extend their control and influence.
And I'd like to extend the invitation to you, our listeners, to join this conversation. You can join us now at our toll-free number. Please feel free to do that. It's 866-733-6786. Again, join us toll-free, 866-733-6786, or email us, forum@kqed.org, or go to our website, kqed.org/forum, and click on this segment. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. We're talking about the ongoing crisis in Iraq possibly moving closer to civil war. We spoke earlier with BB correspondent in Baghdad, Gia Goal, and with us for the hour, Martha Crenshaw, who is a senior fellow in the Center for International Security and Cooperation at Stanford in the Freeman Spogli Institute, and Aaron David Miller, vice president for New Initiatives and distinguished scholar at the Woodrow Wilson International Center for Scholars and former advisor of both Republican and Democratic Secretaries of State and author of a book which will be out in October called The End of Greatness, Why America Can't Have and Doesn't Want Another Great President. Jeffrey White is also with us this morning, defense fellow for the Washington Institute for Near East Policy, who spent 34 years at the Defense Intelligence Agency, and his work there included the planning of the 2003 invasion of Iraq. And you are also welcome to join this conversation and to join the program. Our toll-free number again is 866-733-6786. You can also email us, forum@kqed.org, or post questions or comments onto our website, kqed.org/forum, or tweet us. Our Twitter handle is @KQEDForum. Let me go right to some callers, and Scott, let's begin with you. Good morning, Scott.
Hey, good morning. Listen, many years ago there was some talk about splitting Iraq up into three parts, Kurds in the north, Sunnis and Shiites. I can't remember. I think the Sunnis were in the center, splitting up rural rights equally. And if we were to theoretically, gee whiz, drop a 500,000 troops down like General Shinseki said years ago, put the entire country on lockdown, would that have, number one, stopped all of this mess? And is that still feasible with the mess that we've got going right now?
Well, a couple of good questions there, and I thank you, Scott. Let me go to Aaron David Miller. There was talk, certainly even from Vice President Biden, about division of Iraq, and I'd like you to address that, if you would, Aaron. But also that whole question of just, you know, President Obama's getting a lot of heat now for pulling out troops. There are many, not only on the right, but many even supporters of the president who said he should have kept troops there.
Look, I think we probably would have been able to contribute, and here's the problem, significantly, marginally, profoundly to the current situation, making it better since 2011, had there been a status of forces agreement and a significant residual presence? I mean, it's a counterfactual. We don't know. My main point, however, is this. No amount of American forces would have been able to create the kind of political contract between the governed and those who govern that is critically important for bucking up the institutions of the state. You're an Iraqi Sunni. Why do you want to fight for a government that is either exclusivist or triumphalist and is perceived among many Iraqi Sunnis and Kurds to basically be a shilling for the Iranians? The fact that this state, quote unquote, this military, which had been coup-proof by Maliki, and compromised its own effectiveness, disintegrated so quickly. And as Jeffrey points out, 5,000 guys with relatively unsophisticated weaponry advanced through large swaths of the northern and western parts of this country and took over a city of almost 2 million people in a matter of days. What does that say about so many things? So many things we thought were cohesive, concrete, and real in Iraq, it's a pretty sad testament. And my profound conviction is that we probably could have made a difference. We probably could have kept Maliki perhaps on a bit of better behavior, but we couldn't have fundamentally turned around the basic problem, and that is the Shia were less interested in looking toward the future and building a better Iraq than they were settling past scores and ensuring Shia preeminence. And maybe it's understandable given Saddam and his brutality and his own killing machine. Maybe we should understand it. But the problem is we were stuck in the middle of it. And now we risk getting dragged back. One final point. I wonder if, in fact, the situation, as Jeffrey suggests, I think he's right, We always think the end of the world is coming, as we did in Ukraine. I mean, I heard this new Cold War, fulcrum of Western civilization, the entire architecture of post-1991 was going to be completely destroyed. This was a game changer, Putin's annexation of Crimea. Well, it didn't turn out to be any of those things. And I wonder and worry that we look at the situation in Iraq in much the same way. There are natural balancing forces that probably will come to the fore in checking ISIS's spread, including Iran, including additional Sunnis who don't share ISIS's ideology. But I guess my question is, what happens if, in fact, the situation does stabilize and Maliki and the Iraqi Shia want to take back those areas that ISIS has liberated? Are we going to support them through massive use of American air power? and assistance without the kinds of political reforms necessary to stabilize the country over time? I don't know.
Well, there's also, just a quick insert on my part, a lot of geopolitical work that's being done behind the scenes here. I mean, as many know, there was a meeting between the Saudis and the Russians, and how much interest of the Saudis is involved in this, how much Riyadh is involved in this, as opposed to, let's say, Tehran and the possibility of Rouhani making alliance with the United States because of what's going on in Iraq. I mean, it gets very complicated in terms of just the geopolitical picture. And I wanted to bring Ambassador Faisal Esterbadi into this discussion. He's formerly Iraq's Deputy Permanent Representative to the United Nations, 2004 to 2007, presently directs the Center for the Study of the Middle East at Indiana University. Ambassador, good to have you with us. Welcome.
Pleasure to be with you.
At this point, is there a political solution to this?
There is, but the window for it, in my opinion, is closing. First of all, the Iraqi political class and the Iraqis generally, we collectively have to make a decision. Do we or do we not want to live in the same country? If we do, we have to make a positive decision that is in fact the fate we aspire to ourselves, because to put off the decision means that events are overtaking us and that the country is, in fact, in my view, disintegrating. If we do, then we have to look to a leadership that can act as a fulcrum that balances the country's competing interests. And those interests have changed in the last 10 days. The Kurds, in going into the elections in 2014, looked much weaker than they are now. So the balance has shifted, and we have to take that into account if we want to maintain a cohesive country. We need to find a leadership that can be a credible interlocutor with all of Iraq's constituents, including the Sunni and the Kurds. And I think the Shia political parties have to admit to themselves that Nouri al-Maliki can no longer play that role.
Well, he's a lame duck, and maybe things are winding up for him. In fact, Max Boot recently said that he needs to be replaced. The United States ought to, in fact, perhaps work on behalf of replacing him. How much of the United States' role should be in this, if any, as you see it, Ambassador?
Well, behind the scenes, I think the United States can and should play a role. Recently, Ambassador Crocker said on CNN that the United States has been disengaged too much. I agree with that. I think the United States needs to re-engage. But the place where the United States can play a role, which was not available months ago, is to speak to the Iranian interlocutors with whom it is now publicly speaking, and to come to some understanding that chaos in Iraq is not in Iran's interest. It may be that Iran does not want a stable Iraq, but it certainly does not want a chaotic Iraq, and that its current support for Maliki is tending the country towards genuine chaos.
Ambassador Faisal Esterbadi, again, formerly Iraq's Deputy Permanent Representative to the United Nations for Iraq, 2004 to 2007. Ambassador, thank you so much for joining us. Good to have
you.
My
pleasure. Thank you. Goodbye.
And let me have another caller join us. And Corey, that's you. Good morning. You're on the air.
Good morning. Thanks for taking my call. I have a question, or my question is in regards to Turkey. What is the response of Turkey, the short-term and long response, especially in the context of the ongoing Kurdish peace process in Turkey, and especially in regards to the northern part that is Kurdish occupied?
That's an important question. Jeffrey White?
Well, I would just say that from a military standpoint, I think the Turks are being, you know, very cautious about their response to what's going on with the ISIS advance.
I think we ran into some problem with that line there. I think caution is certainly the watchword now under the Turkish government. Let me go to some of your emails here. Stav writes, after the First World War, the European victors drew the map lines of the Near and Middle East without regard for the resources or tribes there. Thus, did the Kurds end up as the most populous group without a state? Churchill himself came to realize the magnitude of that oversight, and we hear daily about various conflicts in the region. The Americans had a chance to calmly divide a country that should not exist into its discrete parts, yet they chose to reinforce the old lines, evidently out of oil interests. Why maintain an untenable situation? Further violence is inevitable. And a tweet from Stephen: Iraq is a democratic state, and we have obligation under UN Charter to defend it. Another online comment from Cullen, who writes, it would be ironic if Barack Obama, who had campaigned against the Iraq war to win the presidency, were now to reengage the U.S. military in Iraq's sectarian conflict. Will we be welcome as liberators a second time around? Would our intervention in Iraq be a cakewalk this time? And here's Paul, who emails us and says, I've heard the militia group referred to as both ISIS, Islamic State of Iraq and Syria, and ISIL, Islamic State of Iraq and the Levant. I'm assuming these are the same groups, though ISIL sounds far more ambitious, encompassing a larger region. I'm not sure why they're referred to by either name. Can you help us here, Martha Crenshaw?
Well, actually, I don't have a very good answer to that either, because it's a question that I've asked myself. Basically, the notion of the Islamic State of Iraq and Syria comes from the fact that al-Qaeda in Iraq transformed itself into the Islamic State of Iraq at about the time of the surge in the awakening, in order to try to increase its legitimacy in Iraq, because one phenomenon we've not talked about very much is the foreign fighter phenomenon. ISIS or ISIL shares the characteristics of al-Qaeda itself in having very large foreign contingent, and this is one of its resources or assets that makes it even more dangerous. So the notion of trying to transform yourself into a state and thus some sort of legitimate body was something that was it's a step that was taken pretty early on. And again, because the forerunners of ISIS were seen as foreigners in Iraq and also in Syria. So the notion of calling yourself the Islamic State, first of Iraq and Syria, first Iraq, then Syria, then the Levant, I think shows the expansiveness of the goals of this particular organization.
Aaron David Miller, is there a likelihood that what may come out of this is a kind of ineluctable redrawing of lines and territorial configuration?
You know, it's fascinating. The Arab world has maintained, certainly before 2011, a high degree of centralization of power. From the early 70s to 2011, you saw either acquiescent or adversarial autocrats rule this region. We confronted the adversarials, Saddam Hussein, Muammar Gaddafi, and we worked with the acquiescence, Abdullah Saleh of Yemen, Ben Ali of Tunisia, Mubarak of Egypt. Now they're all gone. And what you're seeing with this absence of centralization and cohesion is a trend toward decentralization. And you see it everywhere. In Syria, it has reached its most, acute form of the prospective disintegration of the institutions of the Syrian state, and the largest single refugee crisis since the end of World War II. In Lebanon, Lebanon's been a non-state for years. The putative state of Palestine looks still, even with this interim government between Fatah and Hamas, looks like Noah's Ark. There literally are two of everything. Two little statelets, two constitutions, two sets of security services, two sets of patrons. And Libya, which, you know, was a manifestation of successful multilateral intervention, is now just ridden with tribal and ethnic divisions. Iraq is simply responding, it seems to me, to the growing natural trend in this region of decentralization. Doesn't mean necessarily fragmentation, and I suspect the neighbors will continue to have a stake in maintaining the fiction that in fact Iraq is a cohesive state with a central government who controls all of its territory, even though that's hardly the case now more than ever. One final point. In view of this disintegration in the Arab world, decentralization, and the Arab kings have fared much better than the phony republics, I'd watch the non-Arabs. Three states, Israel, Iran, and Turkey, all politically stable at home, all with tremendous potential economic power, all with the capacity to project their power beyond their borders. The Arab world is in crisis now. Dysfunction, decentralization, and very bad governance, and it's hard to imagine it's going to get out of this rut anytime soon.
Let me bring another caller on. Larry, thanks for waiting. Join us. You're on Forum.
Hi. How large is the militant force? Is it really just 5,000 soldiers, or are there others involved? It seems like a fairly small number to have created so much chaos.
Do we know the actual size, Martha Crenshaw, of ISIS?
You know what? We have our guesstimates, 5,000 or 6,000, maybe more, maybe fewer. Recruits coming in, though, all the time, depending. It's really very hard to say. And, of course, part of the power of these groups is not their numbers. You can't really say because they have a certain number of adherents of some sort. And remember, these are not necessarily, this is not like an army organized in terms of brigades and battalions and platoons where you know exactly who does what. This is a much more looser, more floating sort of organization. So numbers aren't everything by any means. And a big question is, why is it that these very extremist groups like ISIS manage to come to the forefront in conflicts like Syria or Iraq? How do they gain ascendancy over other groups whom we now call moderate Sunni groups in these countries, although that's probably quite a misnomer? We don't really understand necessarily the sources of their strength, but it's not merely in numbers at all.
Now, let me go back, Jeffrey White, to you on this. If we're talking about numbers in Iraq, Sunnis far outnumber Shia, and in that whole region, Sunnis far outnumber Shia.
How important? Well, they don't outnumber the Shia in Iraq itself. The Shias are the majority population in Iraq.
I'm sorry. Let me correct myself. In the region I'm talking about now, and this may indeed be a conflagration in the whole region. So how important are those numbers, especially as ISIS moves along and does get more recruits?
Well, numbers certainly matter. The issue, though, is to what extent these groups can mobilize support from within these very large numbers of people. ISIS has been successful in mobilizing support, for a number of reasons. One, it has a very clear ideology. We don't like it, but it provides, in a sense, very clear and simple solutions to complex problems. And people that are under stress, under attack by various forces, tend to gravitate to those kinds of, or the kinds of groups that provide those kinds of solutions. Also, ISIS is very coherent itself. It's highly cohesive, very disciplined, and it thinks about what it's going to do. It operates carefully, not to say cautiously. It plans ahead. It thinks about what it's doing. It's a very effective organization, and in these very fluid, complex, uncertain situations, a group that has those kinds of characteristics can go a long way, especially when everybody else is more or less disorganized, confused, uncertain about what to do. So there's a very these small and highly disciplined groups can be very potent in these kinds of situations.
Well, when you speak about groups being disciplined and cohesive and effective as organizations, I think of the Revolutionary Guard. I mean, if they're going to get involved in this conflict, and it could be a greater regional conflict, I guess the real question is, in fact, I'm looking at an online question to this effect by a listener named Matthew, who's interested in hearing what would bring countries like Iran into this conflict, or for that matter, Turkey.
I think in the case of Iran, they're already involved to a significant extent. I don't think that they're involved with their own kinds of forces like the IRGC, although that's not completely clear. But in Iraq, they have a lot of surrogate forces they created over time, Shiite organizations and groups that the Iranians either control or can influence to act. And it's already, these kinds of forces are already being employed pretty significantly in the fighting against ISIS north of Baghdad. So Iran has got a hand in it. It also reportedly has advisors working with the Maliki government and the Iraqi forces, helping them plan, conceive, how to deal with this ISIS invasion and in advance. So Iran is in it. I saw a report just a few minutes ago that some 5,000 Iranians have volunteered to fight in Iraq. And of course, this is a
you know, a long-standing way to get your own forces into a country. You find volunteers, and then you send them in. It's been going on for a long time in various places. For Turkey, I think they have some, you know, a difficult situation. They have to watch carefully what's going on here with the Kurds. The Kurds in Iraq look very much to be going to significantly enhance their position in Iraq. They've already assumed control over Kirkuk. They're providing some of the most effective defense against any kind of ISIS advance. They've taken control of one of the border crossings to Syria. They're conducting, what I would call an aggressive defense of their areas in northern Iraq. And Turkey has to watch to see how powerful these Kurds are going to become coming out of this situation.
Again,
the Kurds also have a problem in that they have at least some of their diplomats seized by ISIS in Mosul, from their consulate in Mosul. And this is going to complicate any kind of Turkish military reaction to the situation. Right now, the Turks are more or less playing down that aspect of the problem. I don't think they want it to become a huge emotional issue in Turkey, which might force their hand. So, the Turks just face lots of difficult choices and no easy answers, here, somewhat like the United States.
Jeffrey White with us from Alexandria, Virginia, defense fellow with the Washington Institute for Near East Policy. And let me get another call on here, and that's Rebecca from up in Geyserville. Good morning.
Good morning, Michael. My question was, one of your commenters mentioned that this ISIS group, they offer simple solutions, and that's part of, you know, what is their attraction to people is offering, you know, so-called simple solutions, but I'm curious what those simple solutions are. I have not seen any of these very extreme groups have any type of idea of how to actually govern once they're in control. There was a movie maker that came out with a documentary about a year or two ago. I'm blanking on it, but he essentially did a documentary looking at some of these Islamic extremist groups. And his conclusion was that they don't have a governing ideology at all. And if that's true, I don't really see how we're going to fix a lot of these problems over there. Not that I feel that it is our responsibility to do so, but how do you deal with a group of people that really has no capability of governance, manufacturing, any type of thing? How are they going to solve these problems?
Well, Rebecca, thank you for that call. Actually, let me go to you, Martha Crenshaw, because as we said before, they may not have the numbers to govern, but they pretty much established infrastructures. They did pretty similarly to what Hamas did in Gaza, and they have instituted Sharia law.
Yes, actually, they have a fairly detailed governing plan, and they've been very good at communicating it. They've planned it for a long time as to what their idea of their version of a beginning caliphate would look like. And, of course, we have areas under their control in Syria. We will now have areas under their control in Iraq. They've already started promulgating various sorts of laws, such as that women must stay at home, no drinking, no smoking, the various sorts of rather puritanical edicts that they govern by. And if we want to see an example of an Islamist movement that constituted a government, we need look no further than the Taliban in Afghanistan. It was only recognized by three states worldwide, and it was not in control of all of Afghan territory. But if you want an idea of what such a movement looks like in power, it functioned. It had a form of justice. And often it's their imposition of courts and law and rules and regulations that makes people support them, because they've lived under lawless and corrupt circumstances for so long that a very puritanical group looks attractive, at least at the outset, until you begin to chafe under There are sorts of rules and regulations, such as that no education for women, the burqa. So we're actually quite familiar with the type of regime that that ISIS would institute were they actually able to govern territory. Now, that's not to say that they can govern the territory that they've now apparently taken in Iraq, because, as I've pointed out, there are a lot of divisions among Sunnis themselves, and they may not all accept these groups in the long run. But they do have a governing platform.
A lot of this brutality that we're seeing now under ISIS, let me go to you on this, Jeffrey White. The argument is that Americans, when they were there, held up a lot of that brutality, and then they left, and it just kind of unleashed and opened up a Pandora's box.
Well, I think I would say that if the Americans were there in any kind of strength at all, this wouldn't have happened. There would be still be the crisis of Maliki's relationship with his non-Shia and even his Shia, you know, constituencies and so on. But the presence of American forces, I think, would have mitigated a lot of the worst aspects of the Iraqi situation.
We're coming up the end of the hour here. I just want to go back to Aaron David Miller with seconds left here. What about breaking it up into three units? I'm looking at an email here, Aaron. It says, why would that be a disaster if it represented the will of the people? The current boundary is completely arbitrary, established by outside powers a century ago.
Not entirely sure that would reflect the will of the people, although you don't know. Iraqis have voted according to a new political system and voted en masse for something broader than their own narrow confessional groups, number one. Number two, I don't think the neighbors would like that at all. And I think, frankly, the fiction or maintaining the fiction of Sykes-Picot is something that, frankly, is probably in the interests of the international community, at least for the moment, and then to try to see whether or not you can resolve these problems within these conventionally accepted borders, not alter them and create havoc and disrespect for borders.
Well, we'll continue.
That's a prescription for trouble.
We'll continue to monitor this trouble and hope that there are better prescriptions. Thanks, Aaron David Miller. Thanks to Martha Crenshaw. Thanks to Jeffrey White. And also thanks to Ambassador Faisal Istrabadi. And thanks to you, our listeners. Another hour ahead, we're going to talk about the Koch brothers in the hour ahead, a new film about them in terms of their force on politics. Stay tuned. I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio, the Germanicos Foundation, and the Generosity Foundation, and by a generous gift from Jan Schremm and Maria Minetti Schremm, founders of Clos Pegas Winery, who believe that all people deserve access to education, information, and culture for a lifetime of exploration and learning.